Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room.
Ah, here's our room. True crime.
You've now entered the House of Mystery on KYAH. Utah's Talk Authority with your hosts, Al Warren and Kev Thompson. Also, Julie Saville with a paranormal report. The True Crime Commentary by Stephen David Lampley and Dr. Joseph Usensky's Conspiracy Countdown.
Hello?
Hello, this is 911. We just received a call from this number. Is everything all right?
No, I think someone's in my house.
Can you see the person at this time, sir?
No, I think he's in the fucking living room.
Okay, listen closely. I'm going to have to move you to a safer place in your house. I've dispatched officer to your location. Where are you right now?
The Tucson Murders True Crime Tours offers historic crime investigations into forgotten, lost crimes in Tucson, Arizona. To book your tour, call 520-323-3406 or email info@thetucsonmurders.com. Did he make it? Book your tour and find out.
Misery. Let's company. We can start a company. And make misery. Frustrated, corporate. You're back in the House of Mystery on KKNW 1150 AM Seattle. I'm Al Warren.
And I'm Kev Thompson.
And here we go again. So I've got my coffee, and we're ready. This is going to be quite the ride today. We've got a returning guest, and always interesting. He's been a writer in both fiction and nonfiction, and history. And very interesting books, and he's really a Ted Bundy expert. So we're going to be talking about that last book he did, The Bundy Secrets, and that's Hidden Files on America's Worst Serial Killer. And he's also got a new book coming out in April, so we got lots to talk about. So Kevin Sullivan, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been some time since I've been on the show, so I'm happy to be back with you all.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. It's just we've been moving and busy, and it's crazy, you know. Mm-hmm. Up to 5 days a week now, and we've got a couple more stations and keeping us running.
That's great. That's great.
Yeah,
all together we're 7 days a week between all the stations.
Yeah.
Cool.
We're running. And it's all crime and history, so and it seems to be a lot of interest. So it's really been growing, and we just picked up two stations in Utah, and we appreciate having them on board. That was KYH 540 AM and KFVX 98.3.
If your things keep going, I'm just saying you'll be picking up even more stations. You'll keep going. It'll just be on a roll.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're just taking it where the people want it. And we're just rolling it out, and we talk with people like you and a lot of authors, filmmakers, and we're just putting it out there, and people really seem to enjoy this type of radio. So, I think it's a great alternative to all the political radio and talking going on, right?
Because
there's so much of that.
Absolutely.
It's like, get your head out of that. Let's talk about something a little more interesting, you know. So it's been good for us. So how have you been? What's been going on with you? I haven't. Yeah, you're right.
Just extremely busy. So much going on. I've been writing just a lot, and the new book that is just coming out, called Through an Unlocked Door, that it was scheduled to be coming out April 1st, but I talked to the publisher. We had to go through some final things that were pre-publication. I said, so it's April 1st. She said, oh, no, it's going off to the printer in just a day or so. So it probably will be published in the next week or less. just staying extremely. She said, well, you can't really go by that when we post that on Amazon. Should we publish April 1st? A lot of times they are early. But anyway, just a lot of stuff going on. I'm working on another book now. That one I had finished back in late May, and then there was things to do during the year with that. And so just busy. Seems to be kind of like, you know, one book after the other. And besides all that, I have I pastor a small church, and I have a counseling service, and so it keeps me busy. So it's like I'm always going and doing something. So that's how my life has been since you and I talk.
Well, you know, but it's good. It's good to keep busy. It's good to keep doing things and moving forward.
Oh, sure.
I think we, Kevin and I, and even the other hosts we have, we all live pretty busy lives. Mm-hmm. So I agree.
It's actually good to be busy. I couldn't stand not having something constructive to do. So I mean, my wife is just the opposite. She's still working. She says, I can't wait to do nothing. I said, I'm never not going to do nothing. I'll always be doing something.
Yeah, you know, and plus I find it hard myself. Like all of a sudden you've got a day where you're not doing something. It's kind of like, okay.
You feel like you need to be doing something. We go on vacation. I end up working a little bit. And my wife doesn't get mad at me. I just, you know, I have my computer with me, so I have to work a little bit. But she's cool with it.
Yeah, well, that's great, you know, because that's a touchy one. So, this new book that, you know, it's really interesting as in just the the cover and sort of what it's written about. It says through the unlocked door, in walks murder. So this is kind of a little different than just a Ted Bundy book. What is that about?
You know, it's very interesting. I have about 5 publishers, 6 if you count McFarlane's imprint, which is their new imprint called Exposit Books. But I was in a conversation with them about, I'd say a year and a half ago, and they've been wanting me to write another book for them, and it just has never worked out. So we worked out a deal on something, and they said, what do you want to write about? And I said, well, there's this book I've been wanting to write about for years, and I have never been able to get to it. It's always been on the back burner. And when I do write it, I want to call it Through an Unlocked Door. And that was very intriguing to them, and we talked about it. And so when we worked something out and I decided to go ahead and write a book for them, for their new imprint, I said, that's what I'm going to do. So the whole thing that came from, as far as I know, there's not another book out there like it. Nobody seems to talk about that, but here's the deal. When I was a kid, when I was 10 years old, and I talk about this in the preface of the book, and I've spoken about this on other radio shows, but when I was 10 years old, I picked a book off my father's shelf called The World's Worst Murderers by Charles Franklin. I had never, it was an adult book. I just had to read this thing. It's my dad's book. So I started plowing through it, and I read the book within 3 weeks. And about all these different cases of murder. It was, he was an English author. It was published in Britain in 1965. And then in the same year, the American release occurred as well. And so I read it, when I was 10. Well, that was fascinating to me. But it made a real impression on me that no matter when I'm out playing, how nice the sunshine is, the nice people that are walking by me, that evil exists and people can be murdered, that there can be slaughter. And so it kind of piqued my interest and got me to thinking, well, through the years, I would hear about people entering other people's homes through unlocked doors and unlocked windows and being murdered. Now, most of the murder that I have read about in true crime or write about, a lot of it happens, of course, outside the home. But these killers are either going through unlocked doors or in some cases they break in or they kill people on the street. So the unlocked door is an all-inclusive subject, but when you start looking at how often it occurs and the, I almost want to say the American way of looking at things pertaining to unlocked doors, it's absolutely astounding. When murders occur, there was a murder that I wrote about in Pennsylvania, and this is in the book. A kid named Alec Kreider, he was 16. He had wanted to murder for quite some time. He didn't tell his father, he didn't tell anybody. He decided to pick his good friend, Kevin Haynes, and in the middle of the night, he left his home, went into their home. He knew their home would be unlocked. It was. He got in there and was able to kill the parents, kill Kevin, and he would have killed the sister, Maggie, but he didn't know that she was home from college. Now, when I talked to the district attorney in that area, who worked that case, he talked about the people there that in this area. He said, until that occurred, many people left their doors unlocked. And you can see from the reports there that it was a common thing to leave their doors unlocked at night. And so when I, spoke to him about this, the murders that happened a number of years earlier, you could see that once they happened, people started locking their doors, people put in alarms. Some people couldn't sleep at night. They had to keep looking out the window, just abject fear. They took it into the irrational level. And, if they didn't have guns, they bought them. If they had guns, they bought more ammunition. And it was this reaction to it. So you would think that that might stay, not the irrational portion of it, but people would say, yeah, it happened once, it could happen again. So the DA told me, said, but, you know, he said, it kind of went back to normal. And a lot of people around there now, they're sleeping again with their doors unlocked. And, this is a theme that killers, and even those who don't want to kill burglars, they depend on this. They depend on entering homes through unlocked doors, if possible. There are some killers out there who would refuse to break and enter. They would just enter. I mean, coming through an unlocked door is not technically a break-in. It's an unlawful entering.
Really?
But there's a couple killers in the book. I mean, everybody says it's a break-in. It's not. Somebody broke into my car. You start asking him. It's on the street. Was your car locked? No. I said, well, then that's unlawful entering. That's not a break-in. They didn't break into the car. They entered it unlawfully. But people have these things in their head about what, the law says about that. So it's an unlawful entry, but there wasn't any forced entry. That's another way cops look at it. Was there forced entry? No, we can't find forced entry. Therefore, they must have entered through an unlocked window, unlocked door, and that's how that works. So anyway, when I was growing up, I would compile these things in my mind. I remembered a lot of them. And so when I decided to write this book, I thought, I'm finally going to do it. I'm going to write a book about all of these things happening and how, and the almost the psychological disadvantages people have and of not understanding how dangerous it could be to leave their doors unlocked. And in fact, in the preface, I also talk about, I don't know if you all have ever seen the movie Sea of Love with Al Pacino and Ellen Barkin. But at one point, Pacino and Barkin are walking down some streets in New York City, and he's pointing out various areas where murders have occurred, these terrible things that he had to work, these cases that he had to work. And, she's not a homicide cop. And he said, he talked about how people, he said, we see things, cops who do this, we see things differently than you see things and other people see things. So they don't see this stuff. And so they view the world differently. So I say in the preface, I said, it's my hope that by the time people get done reading this book, they will all see the truth of what all this is, what's out there.
Yeah, you have to protect yourself. I don't think that people realize that the law isn't really going to protect you. And I don't mean that as a slam toward cops, but I mean to sit there or to say, well, you know, my door was open. It's against the law to come in. That isn't going to stop a killer. He's going to come in. You know, so we've got to look out for ourselves. I mean, the law is there to help us. But that's
absolutely
how I see it. Yeah.
In fact, I have a friend who was a police officer for years, and he said people need to learn to protect themselves because, he said, usually they respond to things that are already occurring.
Exactly. I was just trying to make that point.
Yeah, something's in process, and very often we can't get there soon enough. And, a lot of times the case really starts when you're standing over a body. And that's a terrible, terrible thing. So people need to be able to defend themselves. And I had a lady come to me once, and she had a problem with an ex-husband who she feared was violent. She said, should I get a restraining order? I said, you actually need to get a handgun, and you need to go be trained with that handgun. I've been a firearms instructor to people, but I was kind of like out of that then. I wasn't doing that. I'm doing casing for people. But I said, you've got to get a gun and you've got to train for it. You've got to psychologically be ready to use that gun. I said, you can get a restraining order, but that's not going to stop these people. And I have heard 911 calls where you could hear them breaking in and the woman screaming on the line, hurry and get here. And in one case, you could hear this woman being beaten to death by her husband. And she had a restraining order. So that's what a restraining order will do if you have nothing else to protect yourself. So even cops know this. It really is up to people to look after themselves, protect themselves. And one of the best ways they can do it is lock their doors and their windows at night.
Right.
That's the first step, anyway.
If I can amend what you were just saying, allow me to agree wholeheartedly. As a law enforcement officer, you know, getting a restraining order is the pat answer. I agree with the handgun, because a restraining order in and of itself is just a piece of paper. It doesn't change the psyche of the person who you're trying to restrain.
No. Unfortunately not. No. Terrible. And, you know, so many of these people end up, you know, being assaulted or something else happening, and nobody wants to talk about it. I remember, does everybody remember the massacre at Luby's back in Texas, back in the 1980s, it was 80s or 90s maybe? A long, long time ago, a guy drove his truck, I think in Canarda, I'm not sure. He drove his truck into the middle of this place and got out of his truck and started shooting. There was about 80 people there. Most of them scattered. Some of them hid underneath tables. And the ones who stayed there and hid, a lot of them were killed. Now, there was one woman there who had petitioned to get a concealed carry license in Texas and had been turned down. And she had a gun in her glove compartment, and she was going to eat it with her elderly parents that day, or maybe they weren't quite elderly, but they were her parents. And she thought about taking the handgun in with her, but she said, no, I'm going to obey the law. And she didn't do it. And she was in there, and both her parents were killed. And she was instrumental in getting that passed in the state of Texas. And I remember I was on the phone talking to a sheriff, not about that, but about this other thing I was trying to, this other case, this other thing I was trying to find out about. And we talked about concealed carry, and I said, how do you feel about that? And he said, well, I kind of hate to see it, which is unusual for police officers to say that. Most of them understand that people need to arm themselves. I said, well, you know, I'm going to get mine. What he didn't know is I'd already been carrying one. I had started carrying a handgun illegally. After Luby's, I thought, I am not going to be in arrest. I've been well-trained in handguns and firearms since I was 16. I'll be 63 next month. And I said, I am not going to be in a restaurant and have somebody come in with my wife and kids and do something. It's not going to happen. It's not. And if I get arrested, then I'll have a misdemeanor charge or whatever it is, but I'll be alive. And so I did. So when the concealed carry came along, I just made it legal. But that was it. I was going to do it. And if they took it away today, I'd be carrying one today. It wouldn't matter what the law says. Yeah. So anyway, that's just how I view it. Everybody's got to take their own personal responsibility in saving themselves. Police will do everything they can to help you if they can get there. The bottom line is that's going to be a problem because they're not waiting around at your home when something happens. So they do everything they can. But there's very limited from what they can do.
Yeah. Yeah, they've got donuts to eat.
Yeah. That's true.
Oh, wow.
No. I used to eat donuts. I don't eat those anymore.
Yeah.
Hand off the cops. They really do a good job. I've worked with a lot of them on the right and the crowd. I nearly became a police officer at one time, but I had an accident and injured my leg, and I couldn't go down that road.
Now, you picked 13 high-profile cases. Which cases kind of did you pick, and how did you pick those?
Well, there's some even more high-profile than others. As I say in the preface, some of these got national attention. Some of them just kind of shook a region, and then others were more localized, but they're all high-profile for whatever area that they're in. But a number of them made national news. One case I write about in there is the Night Stalker, Richard, you know, Ramirez, right. And many of the homes that he went into were through unlocked doors or windows. So he was one of these people that wanted to take advantage of them. I mean, he would jimmy some things open, but also listen, when people don't have a really strict set of procedures in mind to protect themselves, they may even fail to compensate in certain areas. I write about grounds where people have, for example, maybe their door, front door was locked or their window, but they have a sliding glass door, and because it was in the back door, it was left open, you know? Yeah. And they're thinking, well, you know, I lock up my front door, but maybe not my back door. And there's a number of people that when people have been able to jimmy those doors and slide them, that is so easily rectified, but just putting a piece of wood or a bar down in that door so that it cannot slide. But a lot of people don't do that.
Easy fix.
Easy fix. I mean, you're not going to open it. You can't get it open. Jimmy all day, you're not going in that way. But it's very easy. So he was one that would look for those kinds of easy entrances. And there were other things. I mean, I write about a guy that here in a family in Versailles, Kentucky, which is about 15 miles outside of Lexington. This is so exceedingly strange when you think of murders happening just by chance. There was a fellow that, from all outward appearance, was a normal guy. He was a nurse up in Indianapolis. He had a lot of friends. He was well respected. He made decent money. He made good money. He just was normal. And he got in his car one night and he drove south. And he came through Kentucky, and Indianapolis is a straight shot down to Louisville, but he didn't stop in Louisville. I don't know which way he went. If he came to Louisville and then he turned and he headed toward Lexington, I don't know, but he got to Lexington, Kentucky, and then he veered off of that and he went to Versailles, Kentucky, a small town, and he was just meandering through the darkened streets of Versailles. He stopped at a house at 311 Douglas Avenue, which was on the corner of Douglas and a gray street, a small street. And for some reason, he just got out and he walked up the front steps of that house, turned the knob on the front door, and entered. It was open. And the folks that lived in that house, at their request, I changed their last name. I changed their names, but I left the name of the killer in there. Anybody Googles it, they have found the real name of the victim. But what happened was, he wandered around in the lower level of the home. Upstairs, there was his son. There was a young boy sleeping and a couple of girls, three children. The dad was asleep upstairs, and the mother was working, I believe, for UPS. She was at work. She worked third shift, and the door was unlocked. And so he comes in, and he ends up getting a butcher knife out of the kitchen, cutlery thing where you pull one out, I guess, or it might have been in the door. But he got a butcher knife. He walked up the steps, and he walked in this kid's room. We don't know how long he stood over him, but he started stabbing him in the head, in the head and neck. And, of course, that little boy expired within just a few minutes. And as soon as this attack started, this guy was making noise, the kid started screaming. The sister jumped out of bed and tried to attack this guy, and he threw her down or something. The father heard it. He got up, and he wrestled with this guy. And he managed to pin this guy. Well, I think one of the kids was able to call 911, and so they arrested him. Now, what happened to this man, nobody knows. Well, when people that his attorneys got to him, and then people that knew him, he was in a state, because when they said mostly he was, you know, psychotic. Well, what's weird is that he had never exhibited any symptoms of that. And I don't believe drugs were even a factor, but you can't get anything more bizarre Now, here's the key. Now, the parents, you know, they I can tell you now on this show, they were not pleased that I was writing about their child. In fact, they found out because a fellow that I know who's also a police officer is their neighbor. They left there. They moved from there. They moved. That was a rental. They moved, and they ended up buying a house somewhere else in the city. And this cop guy that I know, he's his neighbor. And he just happened to tell him that I was writing a book on this. And I thought, oh, I wish you hadn't done that. But he did.
Yeah, great.
And so I had some, it wasn't free. But I said, okay, here's what I'll do. I said, if they request I not use a name. And I said, I will not do that. But I said, I won't change anything else. And I won't not write about it. And I said, besides, if you see it, you'll see that everything that I write about in there is already information that is released. And so anyway, but I changed the names. But you know, in a case like that, I wouldn't even contact the family. I don't want to bring more pain into their lives by asking them to remember things or to do things. It's my job just to write about what has occurred for the benefit of society at large. And so the last thing I wanted to do was create a problem for them. So once they contacted me and we discussed it, I said, okay, you want the name change? I'll be more than happy to do that. And I'm so sorry for your loss. But as a true crime writer, you will run into that occasionally. And people will want to talk to you. And I've never found it fun. I've never found it nice to do. And it's not easy for me to have to talk with them about that. But when they want to contact me and talk, you know, that's fine. So anyway, but yeah, but it's a strange case. And so you go from something like Richard Ramirez. Then I also write about that Resendez guy who was the railroad killer. Then I also write about Tommy Lynn Sells, who liked to call himself Coast to Coast. And there was a number of things he got into. Yeah, he just liked to call himself that. And he used to ride the rails too, and he would kill people. So just things like that. So some of these cases people will recognize immediately, but others they may not. But the one central theme running through them all will be unlocked doors and unlocked windows. And then there will be cases I talk about here where the same killer doesn't necessarily, while I'm talking about a particular story, go through an unlocked door or something like that. But it's just also to go deeper into how they committed murder. But almost all the killings in there are having to do with this central theme. And it's amazing because, again, this is something that people don't think about very often. And I say in the afterword or whatever the folder is calling it, I said, this won't be the last time that even the things I've written about here, people are still going to be murdered in their homes in the future.
Right.
By killers coming through the unlocked door. But I said, I'm hoping that if you read the book, if you're not, if you're locking your door, great. If you're not, if you could begin doing so, and do it consistently, then good, because you could save not just yourself and someone you love. And that's the absolute truth. So it won't guarantee you not having an encounter with somebody bad, but when somebody has to have forced entry into a home, is one thing people need to remember. Many homes have dogs, and many people sleep lightly. And there have been more people killed entering homes when they were able to kill the bad guy because they grabbed a weapon and took care of it, or they forced the person to flee and nobody was harmed. But when you have the door that's unlocked, you are, without even meaning to, you are inviting disaster. And I'm not talking about unintelligent people. I write about a doctor, the Pettit family out of Connecticut. He was a doctor, and the family was highly educated, but they left the door unlocked. And everybody in the house was killed, but the doctor. And the people doing the break-in, that's the first time they had committed murder. But the one guy, check this out, he'd been burglarizing homes in the area 14 years, and he'd been going in mostly unlocked homes at night. You imagine that?
Yeah.
I couldn't imagine going to sleep at night without locking my house up. It just wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
Now, what about killers that are able to charm their way in, like Ted Bundy? Let's segue into him for just a moment.
Well, you know, Bundy, now I will say this about Bundy. Bundy also was a opportunist when it came to unlocked doors. Bundy never burglarized the home. And Bundy, when he was on the run, at one point, and he didn't have a vehicle, he didn't know how to hotwire a car, but he would look for people making it easier by having the keys hanging above the little flap, the sun flap, or in the console or in the glove compartment. But Bundy, of course, was, you know, a totally different killer. He was, he would excel at either charm and getting a lady to go with him, which many of them were willing to do, or he could get them to follow him by way of a ruse. If you've ever seen South of the Lambs, and most people have, that thing where the guy's got a cast on his arm, the lady helps him with that.
Oh, yes.
And he's dropping stuff. I mean, they got that all from Bundy.
Yes, and, absolutely.
That's the stuff he did. And, sometimes then he would just whack people in the head after he picked them up hitchhiking. Other times he'd have to lure them like he did Elixir Mamish. He took one victim in the morning on July 14th, 1974. He got Janice Hott to go with him. She drove off with him. He tied her up, kept her all day, sexually assaulted her. Came back that afternoon. About 4:20, Denise convinced Denise Nadlin to leave with him under some ruse, took her to where Janice was. In fact, Bundy would later tell Bill Hagemeyer, who's an FBI agent that worked in the behavioral science unit, and who had become friends with Bundy the last couple of years of his life to obtain information. He said that Bundy admitted keeping Odd alive and then having Nadlin come, and they both saw each other, obviously. And then, of course, one was killed in front of the other. And I say in the book, my book, you know, the Bundy murders, comprehensive history. You can imagine the terror that erupted in one seeing the other murder. And, so Bundy had various ways of obtaining women. He also had various ways of killing women. Bundy would occasionally want to render the woman unconscious by a blow to the head with a crowbar. And then he wanted to do things with them, and he didn't want her a part of it. He wanted her unconscious. If they'd wake up, he'd hit them again, and he just wanted to do things. And then there were times when he wanted them to be awake, and he actually wanted them to be very fearful. And that's what the case with Otten and Aslan, having them two together, and then seeing one killed for the other, and then, the other poor girl knows that she's going, and you just can imagine the horror. And so he was a planner of murder. He was also an opportunist of murder. And even Bundy took advantage of the unlocked door. Actually, I didn't include Bundy. I've written so much about Bundy. I've written 3 books, over 600 pages about the guy. I just didn't even bother about including him in this book. I said, no, I'm done with him.
Without sounding macabre, when I was in college, I was studying serial killers, and I really kind of developed an admiration for Bundy, because how many serial killers do you know of that actually defended themselves or represented themselves in court?
Yeah, poorly, but he did it. Bundy was it's kind of funny. Bundy would write a brief, or he'd write something and petition the court about something that the prosecution was doing, and a lot of times he could shut these things down. But when it came to helping in his own defense for the actual trial, he was a disaster, and he was, an impediment. And I say that the folks in Florida defending him would have rather done it with him in absentia or not there, because he was always getting in the way. And the attorneys who knew him that had helped him before said, Ted, you know, you don't have the experience to do capital cases. You're trying to save yourself. You got to have people that are very experienced at capital cases to if you want to be saved. So Ted was a hard-headed kind of person, slow learner, but he was – the thing about Bundy, I've always said this, and that Bundy is kind of like America's Jack the Ripper. I don't think he's ever going to go away. People are going to keep reading about it. My Bundy books consistently sell well, especially my book, The Bundy Murders. It's always just selling out there. And it's the same way. People are going to keep reading about this guy. And I guess everybody else's book on Bundy sells well, too, who's so adamant Brett. And even though we don't know who Jack the Ripper was, there's that mystique. Bundy has his own mystique. And even though we know who the killer of these girls were, Bundy is so unusual because how often do you find a killer that, first of all, doesn't look like a killer, doesn't act like a killer? You don't want to, he's not covered in tattoos, and he fouls up his language, and he just looks, like somebody that you need to cross the street from. The guy was a rising star in the Republican Party. He was a law student, college graduate, law student. You know, he was everything that you'd think a serial killer would not be. And he was doing so well at one part as a young adult coming up that some of his friends would say, he's destined to become something, important. Well, they were right, but not in the ways that they, believed. He was going to stand out all right. Well, it wouldn't be through success. It would be through all of this terrible, terrible murder. And I remember I wrote in the preface of the Bundy murders that the thing about Bundy with people is this. They have a hard time bringing together the outward Bundy, which is so extremely normal and nice and friendly, with the true inner nature of the man, which is diabolical. And when they try to bring those two natures together, it's kind of like a short circuit goes on, and they just can't really deal with it. They just don't know how that could possibly occur.
Right. Well, I wonder if the police are still kicking themselves, because at one point they had Ted Bundy at the interrogation table. They were actually questioning him as a potential suspect, and they let him go because he did not, like you said, he did not fit that profile.
No.
That they were looking for.
And they never had any evidence on him. I mean, I Bob Keppel, out of your old area, Seattle, the King County folks, he worked, his crew worked exceedingly hard to get whoever this was committing murder in their state. But he slips out and goes to Utah, finally revealed there, and then they put two and two together back here. But you're right, his girlfriend, Liz Clofer, which I call her Kendall, because that's her pen name in my books. So I use her pen name, but she had even contacted the cops. There was a professor, a University of Washington professor, that did contact the cops and said, listen, I got a weird guy in my class. He drives a 1968 Volkswagen. His name's Ted. If I were you, I'd check him out. Well, that was Bundy. And the professor was on to something. So they had Bundy because there had been several calls that came in to their headquarters concerning Ted Bundy. He was, even though he didn't look like a probable suspect because of his background, he was put into a special list of 100 special suspects that they were going to have to go through case by case to do a really thorough job. And it just so happens when he was revealed in Utah, and the Utah authorities called Seattle authorities, he had just come up to the top of the list of the 100 suspects list and just about ready to have his case gone over. Well, in no time at all, the eyes of the investigators of everywhere, Utah, Washington State, Colorado, with Mike Fisher. Everybody knew that's their guy. The only thing we got to do is, the only thing we have to do is put this thing together and prove it. Now, Bundy was so slick with the murders in Washington State that even after he confessed it, Bob Keppel couldn't charge him with one crime because there was absolutely no evidence. None. He was never charged.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, you made the point a little bit ago that Ted Bundy is probably one of the most prolific serial killers, and a lot has been written about him. What makes your book different? You know, what are the secrets or some of the secrets that you reveal about Bundy?
Well, now, I was very fortunate when I decided to write a book about, I was never going to write a book about Ted Bundy, but I was able to meet Jerry Thompson, who came to Louisville, and I live in Louisville, Kentucky. He was a friend of a friend of mine who's now deceased by the name of Jim Massey. And when he came to Louisville, he brought this murder kit. He's got Ted Bundy's murder kit. And Utah authorities have had that ever since Bundy was arrested. But Jerry Thompson has personally had it because he was allowed to keep it and use it as teaching tools at seminars. Well, when he retired, he just took it with him. And really, I've been to Utah. They don't care. A lot of these cops keep all that stuff. Anyway, while he was here, and I got to meet Jerry, and I got to see this murder kit, even before he left, he gave me one of the Glad trash bags that was in Bundy's car. He gave my friend Jim one, too. I said, hey, Jerry, could you write a letter of authentication? He said, yes. And it was having that bag and having had that murder kit in my home that sparked me to write about, and I thought, well, I used to write, I wasn't on staff, but I used to write for a weekly print newspaper called Snitch. It was all about crime on the wall. And it was cool because it was a great venue for people that write true crime. A really good newspaper. It was published in two cities in Kentucky and in four or five other states. But it was great. But it's now out of business. But it was great then. And I thought, well, I'm going to write an article about meeting Jerry and all this stuff and having this murder kit in my home. But then when I couldn't turn loose of the fact that I had this bag from Ted Bundy's car. And he would use these great big glass trash bags to put the victim's clothes in. He would never, when he dumped the victims, he would leave them nude. They might have a beaded necklace, but that was it. And he would put the clothes in dumpsters down the road or somewhere. And he would use these bags. So when I started writing about Bundy, when I started researching, I had a lot of people tell me, don't do that. There's a number of books on him. It's an old case. Now don't do it. Something within me said, keep going. And so I did. When I was halfway through the book, it was astounding. I was finding out new things about some of these murders that had never before been in print. And by the time I was halfway through the book, it started taking on a life of its own. I can get the best example of the new stuff I was getting is this. I worked with all the investigators who worked, main investigators of all the states. I also worked just by phone. I never got to meet him, but I worked with Bill Abmeyer, who was the FBI guy who said in every confession that Bundy ever made at the end. And Bundy trusted him implicitly. Well, I wrote the book sequentially. I began with the murders in Washington State, then I went to the murders in Utah, and then the murders in Colorado. By the time I got to Bundy's foray in Idaho, up to Pocatello, where he killed 12-year-old, Lynette Culver, I had not yet gotten the case file of Lynette. But Mike Fisher, the Colorado investigator, had told me that, well, you know, Bundy drowned her in the bathtub of his room in the Holiday Inn in the Pocatello. I said, oh, okay.
Really?
I thought to myself, well, that's a little bit of change of an M.O., but this is something that's known. So I picked up the phone. I called Bill Hagmeyer. We had something that I needed to talk to him about. I said, Bill, listen, I got somebody's name and her age. I don't have really – I thought really her name and the manner of her death. I don't know anything else about her, and I haven't received the file yet. I want to get your see if you knew anything. So when I told him how Bundy had killed Culver, Bundy had picked her up from a junior high school at lunch. He'd come out, and he wooed her into his Volkswagen and went back to his hotel room. And so anyway, when I told him Bill Hagemeyer said, well, you know, I have great respect for the fellow that told you that, me, Mike Fisher, they know each other and are friends. He said, but I sat in on every confession, and I had never heard that. And I said, oh, well, let me go back and see, and I'll check it out. And I'm thinking, as Bill's telling me this, well, I'm the novice. I'm just doing the research now. He's the expert. Maybe I am wrong, but maybe I got some incorrect information. So I said, Bill, if I find out about it, I'll let you know. I call Mike Fisher. He said, oh, yeah. He said, I got that directly from Russ Renaud, the Idaho investigator, who told me that. I got that from him. So he said, call Russ. So I was able to get Russ's name and number and all that stuff. And called Russ. He said, oh, yeah, that's true. And here's why Bill doesn't know it. And what happened was Russ said, and then after I got the file and I got the transcript, I could see it. They had 1 hour only to talk about two murders. One, the murder Bundy committed while he was driving on September 2nd, 1974, as he was driving to Utah to attend law school. He picked up a hitchhiker in Idaho, murdered her that night. And then, of course, this Culver murder. So Russ said we had only had an hour. We were bouncing back and forth between these two cases. And when we mentioned the matter of death, I think Russ said, like, would it be like cranial damage from like a weapon? He said, no, it would be drowning. But because Bundy had said he'd already placed the body in the Colorado River, a river 5 miles north of Pocatello, which is probably the Snake River, they kind of assumed, I guess, that's what he meant. But as they were leaving the prison, Renaud said to his co-investigator, Randy Everett, he said, you know, Bundy never made it exactly clear how he drowned her. Would you go back and see? So before that meeting had broken up, that hour interview, Bundy said, and he was being as honest as he could be, he said, I know this isn't a lot of time. If you need anything else from me, I'll try to help you out. So he goes back into prison. Lo and behold, they let him back into a room. Now, keep in mind, this shouldn't have happened because technically, Hagemeyer should have been there and Bundy's attorney should have been there. But they let Randy Everett back in his room. 15 minutes later, here comes Bundy. Bundy sits down. So Everett says to him, said, well, you mentioned that that the Culver girl was drowned. Can you tell me about that? He said, oh, yeah, I drowned her in the bathtub. In my room. And then he offered the information. Just out of nowhere, said, I had sex with her after she was dead. And, of course, he was a necrophile, and he loved that. He loved sex prior to their deaths, as they were dying, after that. So Everett goes to him and he just asked him, Everett being normal, he said, you know, why would you do this? He said, it was just the madness. So what can I tell you? It was the madness. But anyway, so I get this information, it's confirmed. So I know something that Bill doesn't know. It's not Bill's fault that he doesn't know it. The problem was he wasn't in this meeting. And all these years have elapsed. He just didn't know it. And so, I mean, it was weird. So I sent him an email. I said, hi, Bill. And I said, oh, well, it's true. You know, and actually, I put that email as I'm explaining what happened in this in my second book, which is The Trail of Ted Bundy. Digging up the unsold stories. And then, as you mentioned earlier, I wrote a third book called, you know, The Bundy Secrets. But there were things that came out about the murders that were just not – it was information that had never been released before. Same thing about Julie Cunningham. Mike Fisher told me things about that murder that nobody had ever talked about and hadn't been in print before. So there were about three or four murders with information in the Bundy murders that had never been in print before. And – a lot of new stuff that's never been in print before about the case in a more general sense.
Well, it sounds like we're going to have to do a whole other show on just that.
It sounds like it, doesn't it?
Yes. So before we get ready to say goodbye, what's coming up next for Kevin Sullivan?
Well, I'm in the middle of another book now. Of course, I don't really talk about it until I get closer to publication, but it is yet another true crime book. And so I just keep going that direction. And I've done a couple documentaries recently, and I've got another one to do. I've got a documentary on Ted Bundy that I shot in Daytona back in middle December. It will be coming out on the Oxygen Network sometime this year, maybe this spring, summer. I shot another one for a major cable network. I can't say who yet because they haven't given the actual technical release of the network, but I'll let people know on my Facebook page and stuff like that. And then I got another one to that I'm working with a production company that I'll probably be shooting shortly. So just, you know, outside of doing those kind of things and my writing and then everything else I do with the counseling service I have, it'll just be me doing everything I'm doing.
like we said early on, staying busy.
Staying busy, that's the only way I can live. Go ahead.
But today we've talked about two of your works. We talked about Through an Unlocked Door, and we've talked about Bundy Secrets. Where can the listeners find these books?
Okay, Through an Unlocked Door will be in bookstores, Barnes & Noble, and stuff probably within the next month. It's getting ready to be published. And, of course, they can get it off of Amazon. It's available for back order. Now, pre-order, I guess you would say. And all my books, if you go to, the best thing to do, if you want to see all my books, go to my author page, Kevin Sullivan, and you can look me up at the Bundy Murders of Comprehensive History. And then if you click down there on my picture, my author page, it'll have all my books there. And it'll also have links to articles, to blogs I've written, because I've written a good number of blogs for my one publisher, Wild Blue Press. And so you everything there, you can actually see what I have in print, and then people can go from there. So either in bookstores or on Amazon is the best way to do it.
Awesome. And is there a way that the listeners may be able to reach you personally or email you with new ideas?
Well, the best thing to do, I think, is go to my page at wildbluepress.com. Go to the authors and put Kevin Sullivan, or they can Google Kevin M. Sullivan, or just Kevin Sullivan, actually, Wild Blue Press. And it'll bring you up to my pages. And then you can send me a message through there, and I will answer it on there. And I think that's probably the best way to do it, because I used to have a separate email, but I don't have a lot of time to check it. And God knows what's on there. I'll do what I can check it. And my regular email, I don't really do that with, because I have a lot of other traffic that, I don't want to kind of, you know, a lot of other stuff coming in there. But so the best thing to do is contact me through Wild Blue Press, and I will get back with you.
And now let me add this. That's Kevin M. Sullivan, because if you just Google Kevin Sullivan, it comes up as a wrestler.
Well, that too. Now, but it'll also come up with me.
Unless you've got a secret history.
No. See, that's the fourth thing I could do, but I'm going to refrain. Actually, I'm too old now. It would just kind of like fold me up into a little box and mail me off or something.
Well, Kevin, as always, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, thank you very much. It's always great to be here with you all, and I look forward to next time.
Awesome. And so do we. But thank you. Thank you very much for joining us on the House of Mystery.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.